The Dharma, incomparably profound and exquisite, is rarely met with even in hundreds of thousands of millions of kalpas. We now can see it, hear it, accept and hold it. May we realize the true mind of the Tathagata. And that is what our Zen practice is about, is realizing that true mind, which is inherent in each of us. There is no question about that. And countless men and women over centuries, millennia, have proven that fact. So today is day three of this 7-day sesshin here at Turtleback Zendo in Lawrenceville, New Jersey. And I'd like to share with you something of the life of Dogen. Dogen Kigen is considered to be, if you want to call him that, the patron saint of Soto Zen. He was Japanese. He was born in 1200, died at relatively early age of 53, which is somewhat unusual. The Japanese have a reputation for living very long and productive lives, probably because they eat appropriately and they do a lot of physical work. I wanted to say also a little bit about listening to Taisho. Taisho is an expression of Zen in action. It is meant to be listened to from a deeper level than our intellect. This is really, really important. There is a disconnect between our intellect and where we are able to realize enlightenment. And yet, most of us at least begin Zen practice and go hitting ourselves against the wall of the intellect for some time until we finally grasp the fact that we have to understand, search in a different way, outside of thought, because thought creates stories, and with stories we can simply go around and around and around. It's one thing to be able to understand higher mathematics through the intellect, but to realize our true nature, we have to drop beneath that. It is so often said, and people who have had awakening experiences understand this from experience, that when we do have a Kensho experience — Kensho literally means seeing into, meaning seeing into the nature of reality — it is like a mute trying to tell a dream. It cannot be described. We can put words around it, trying to express the experience, but it's impossible to really translate it into words. It is beyond words. It is only that when we have experienced the true nature deeply enough, there is an understanding, an experience of an inherent freedom that lies within each one of us and can be realized if we are willing to grow between the words. One of the benefits of the extended out-breath practice, Sokan is called in Japanese, is that as you breathe out and extend that out-breath over and over again, really giving yourself to it, you will find yourself letting go more and more and more as part of the process, unless of course you try to hang on to the walls. But as you let go more and more, you will find yourself suddenly opening to it's almost like a little spark in the beginning, and as you pay more attention to that little spark and try to stay present with that experience, it will expand. And often a certain amount of fear will come up right then, because this is a space between thoughts. And when we are not thinking, there's an innate fear for many people that we will disappear. As Descartes said, "I think, therefore I am." Well, this I am is a paper doll. This I am is an artificial construct. It's a self-image that we take to be the real person, when it's not at all the real person. Who we really are is so much more amazing, so much more incredible, so much more free than this self-image. And the self-image is a source of our suffering, really. We have to maintain it. We have to support it. We have to defend it. In a moment of embarrassment, to go into that physical, felt sense of embarrassment is to connect with that self-image in a way that it can be let go at least a little bit in that moment. But usually we try to hide from it or deny it or bluster our way through some excuse about it or otherwise pretend it doesn't exist. Tara Brach, who's both a psychologist and a Zen teacher, talks about, actually I think she's Vipassana, but at any rate she's a meditation teacher. She speaks of radical acceptance. And this is a vital part of our Zen practice. Radical acceptance means that we see the moment as clearly as possible, and in seeing it as clearly as possible, we accept the sense that this is how it appears. We're not taking it as absolute reality. We're accepting that, okay, this is what it feels like, or this is what it looks like, or this is what I think it is. That's radical acceptance. It doesn't mean you condone whatever it is. It means that, okay, this is what it looks like. This is a picture that's flashing on the screen in my mind. And when we allow that, we are able to meet things that are uncomfortable, like embarrassment, like suddenly realizing that we are angry for sometimes not a good enough reason to be angry, and feel that in our body and practice that radical acceptance, which enables us to have space around it, let it go so it doesn't drive our reactions. Instead, we respond rather than react to circumstance. So Dogen was born in an era when Zen practice was just sort of coming into being in Japan. Buddhism had been in Japan for some centuries before, but Zen practice started when Chinese masters would come to Japan and teach the Zen monks who were interested in learning what they had to offer in practicing Zen. And in those days, as we spoke of earlier, the written language was identical. And so when the Chinese priests came, and this is perhaps why calligraphy is such a big thing in Japanese, particularly in Zen monasteries, because that was the way non-Japanese speaking Chinese could communicate with non-Chinese speaking Japanese monks. And so it was that there was a lot of brush talk, brush dance, if you want to speak of it that way, and they were able to communicate. It was quite a ponderous exercise, and often what would have to happen, particularly with one teacher from China who came from a rather more obscure part of China and had a heavy accent, he would speak in Chinese, and a monk or two who could actually understand that dialect of Chinese would transcribe it. And then another monk who knew Chinese and also knew Japanese, probably a Japanese monk, because they were often, at least the higher level of the society was trained in Chinese literature and could read and write Chinese. So that second monk would translate it into Japanese, and then the non-Chinese speakers among the group, and there were probably a fair number of them, were able to understand at last what the master was saying. At the same time, there were other Japanese monks who went to China, even though it was quite a dangerous journey. And there were certain periods of history between Japan and the rest of the world where travel outside or entry into Japan were forbidden. And so some of these monks not only took their lives in their hand because of the perilous travel, but also did so because it was forbidden. At any rate, when Dogen was 3 years old, by the Oriental way of conceiving of age, because in the Orient, children are considered a year old already when they're born. So he was three. By our calendar, he was probably two. His father died. By the time he was seven or eight, depending on which calendar you look at, his mother died. And he was understandably moved by the viewing of the incense smoke that was rising above his mother's coffin, because in those days they actually buried people. Nowadays they don't, they cremate them. There's not enough space left to bury people. But he saw the incense rising and recognized the ephemerality of life, how tentative it is, how quickly it can be snuffed out. He was born into a very high-placed family in the political scene, and so when his mother died, he was adopted by an uncle who was trying to train him in to become a politico. And instead, I think when he was 12, he chose instead to enter a monastery. And that monastery happened to be a non-Zen Buddhist monastery. I believe it was a Tendai monastery, which has a different way of viewing things. But after some time, he found his way to Zen practice, specifically at Kenninji, which is still an ongoing teaching temple in Kyoto, and trained under the master there for, I think it was about a year before the master died, and then continued training under his successor, whose Buddhist name was Myozan, I believe. And then when Myozan decided to go to China for training, Dogen accompanied him also to seek out genuine training. And Dogen stayed there for some years after his teacher died, actually, in China. And eventually, after having received transmission, actually had a deep enough kensho to be sanctioned by his Chinese master, he returned to Japan. Japan in that era was in a quite a violent period. There were wars, political coups, attempts to gain power, and a tremendous amount of bloodshed. And there was also a very powerful, it's interesting that over history, there have been rises to power of Buddhist sects. And in this case, it was the Tendai sect, the monks from Mount Hiei, who actually maintained an army who were in control of Buddhism in Japan at the time when Dogen returned. And he, as he began to rise in popularity, they became quite jealous and at one point burned him out, to the point where, I think it was the local daimyo who gave him a piece of land way out in the middle of nowhere, far, far away from Kyoto, where the Mount Hiei monks, the Tendai monks, were headquartered after he got burnt out and supported the building of a temple there, which still stands, and that is Eiheiji. Because Dogen at some point took on the name Eihei. He's known as Eihei Dogen. And so Eihei Temple, Eiheiji, is now still standing and still a Soto. It's one of the head temples of the Soto sect in Japan. Unfortunately, the Soto sect in Japan has diminished in perhaps one might call it depth, to the point where it's official policy that it's not required for a Soto Zen teacher to have had a Kensho experience before they start teaching. And that's a sad state of affairs, because Buddhism has carried down the generations, as deep practice as it is, and with the great potential for offering a path to awakening for everyone who has a connection with it. And yet if there's someone who is teaching and has not had that experience themselves, it's rather difficult for them to guide their students past a certain point. Rinzai, thanks to Hakuin, has maintained this requirement that anyone who teaches Rinzai Zen has to have had that experience and gone deeply into it, not just having had it. Because here's another thing for people to recognize, and that is that there are various different levels of awakening. And most awakening in the last several centuries have been fairly shallow. It's rare that someone has had a very deep awakening, particularly not a first awakening. And another myth is that you have Kensho and you're home free. Hakuin, who single-handedly resurrected, breathed life back into the Rinzai sect in Japan, to the point where every single current Rinzai lineage traces its history through him, had by his own recognition 19 major Kensho experiences and countless minor ones. Practice is a lifelong endeavor. I would say really it's a lives long endeavor. It is said that like the ocean, the deeper you go, further you go into it, the deeper it gets. Or another metaphor is climbing a mountain. And you'll have a number of people starting off in a group to climb a mountain, hiking up this mountain on a wonderful, glorious day. And at a certain point, they stop to rest at a view. And wow, look at this. This is fantastic. And a number of people just stay there. And the rest of the group goes on up, and then there's another view, even better than the first. And some people stop and stay there too. And then they continue on up. And as the views get better and better, more and more amazing, again, more people drop off at particular points. It's very, very few people. One, two, three people, maybe out of the whole vast group, will actually go to the top of the mountain. And yet it's vital for Buddhist practice, to be able to continue to offer the option to become totally free. Working with a teacher is vital for that process. And what's also vital is working with a teacher who has been there before you. You can really be a true guide. Because that's all teachers are, is guides. Dogen had kind of a wild life, as you already heard. Fair amount of pain and suffering, losing both his parents and being alive during a very volatile period of history, losing friends. These experiences will often deepen a person and make a person want to look outside the box, which is kind of essential for our Zen practice. We have to look outside the box. We grow up learning a particular way to view life, death, how to learn, all the rest of that. We have to step out of that to do our Zen practice so that it can go deep, broad, and beyond where words can function. Dogen famously wrote, "To study the way, the path, if you want, path to awakening, the way to awakening, is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self, that self-image. To forget the self is to be enlightened by the 10,000 things. To be enlightened by the 10,000 things is to remove the barrier between self and other. In reality, there is no barrier. There's appearances. There were individual people that were sitting in this box called the Zendo, on these other things called mats and cushions or zabutons or whatever you want to call them in whatever language. That we go outdoors and we see the trees and we see the sky. There are cars going up and down the roads. And it all seems quite separate. And in one way of looking at it, it is. But there's another, more profound way of experiencing it, where we see that there is no difference. That the tree and the car and this wonderful soft matting in the room here, the red covers on the Mokugyo and the Kesu, each of us sitting here in our clothes, our one being, one marvelous, miraculous expression of the universe. This, realizing this, is what is so freeing to us. How can I be embarrassed? There's nothing outside me to embarrass me or to be embarrassed about. How can I be angry at you when we're not separate? Of course, we can think of this intellectually, and it's not freeing whatsoever when we go that route. But there is a very real potential within each one of us to experience this incredible truth. And it will free us. Of course, then, there is that long maturation that is so vital to bring that to life in everything we do or say or think, so that our behavior, our thoughts, our speech are all coming forth from an awakened point of view, from that awakened experience. That's the hardest work, really, of practice. We can think that sitting here for long hours and the knees hurt and the back hurts and we get bored and we get frustrated and we want it to be over and it's not, and it's too hot or it's too cold, or we have all these other wonderful things we really, really, really would love to do instead. But all of that is actually, when we stick it out anyway, it's honing us so that we can begin to open to the truth. And then, as we said yesterday, this truth is so amazing that it doesn't matter where we are, if we have realized it, even in the worst prison, we are still free. I'd like to share just a little bit more of Dogen here for you. Your search among books, sifting and shuffling through other people's words, may lead you to the depths of knowledge, but it cannot help you to see the reflection of your true self. When you have thrown away all your conceptions of mind and body, the original person will appear in their fullness. Your search among books, sifting and shuffling through other people's words, may lead you to the depths of knowledge, but it cannot help you to see the reflection of your true self. When you have thrown away all your conceptions of mind and body, the original person will appear in all their fullness. To obtain the inestimable benefits of meditation, you should first make a firm decision to practice every day. Your meditation room should be clean and quiet. Wear loose clothing and remove your shoes. Sit on a cushion with legs crossed in as comfortable a manner as possible. Now that is the traditional way of doing it, but it certainly is not essential to practice. And I'd like to share with you the story of Yayako Iwasake, a young Japanese woman whose father, when he hit the age of 60, suddenly came up with a great fear of dying, and it motivated him to get in touch with a Zen master and start practicing Zazen. After a year with that fire under his butt, he had a Kensho experience. And this inspired his daughter, Yayako, to start practicing herself. And the challenge for Yayako was that she had TB. It was endemic in Japan for some time. And as a matter of fact, it was easy to get because it's a very damp and very cold climate. And there's not much in the way of heat available because everything, all fuels except for water have to be imported. And fuel is extremely expensive in Japan. So she practiced, but she was dying. And as she got sicker and sicker and sicker, her body was giving out, feverish, coughing up blood, unable even to sit up, weaker and weaker and weaker. Under these circumstances, this young woman had a deep awakening experience. And she continued on, and the next day it went deeper. And the next day it went deeper. And the next day it went deeper. For 3 weeks, every single day, this opening went deeper and deeper and deeper. And those were the last 3 weeks of her life. Yasutani Roshi apparently was at her deathbed when she died, and he said it was the most peaceful dying he had ever seen. As we get older, we start being concerned about dying. When we're young, it seems like we'll live forever. Old people die, right? Once in a long while, somebody will get killed in a car accident or something like that. It's younger, but it's old people that die, right? And then as we get older, and our joints start hurting, and our hair starts turning gray or white, and we have aches and pains in other places, and maybe some other stuff happens physically to us that's not so pleasant either. We may begin losing our hearing or our eyesight or our hair. And these are all losses that hopefully will motivate us to search within and come to awakening before we don't have a chance to do that anymore. The Buddha, his first practices were ascetic practices. That was what people did back then in India. And for 6 years, he did ascetic practices. It was said that he was down to one single grain of rice a day in terms of food. And then one day he realized that he was going to die if he kept up that regimen. And if he was going to die, he was going to lose his possibility for understanding the nature of suffering and becoming free of it. And so he decided that while he still had a body to do it with, he would shift his perspective and start eating again. At which point, the other ascetic brothers who were practicing with him summarily left. They thought he'd given up the practice and was no good. And that's when he realized he had to go inside, that mortifying the body was not going to do it. And so he sat down under what is now known as the Tree of Enlightenment, or the Bo Tree, and vowed that he was not going to get up until he knew his truth. And as the days wore on, he experienced everything that all of us do, particularly in our earlier years of practice during a sesshin. That was perhaps the original sesshin and the model for the sesshin, actually. And he found himself hurting mightily, found his mind wandering to tantalizing things, and then finally found himself thinking, oh shit, I just don't have what it takes. I don't think I can do this practice. I vowed to do it, but I'm not sure I can manage that. These are all told to us in metaphor, that the Buddhist devil, Mara, is first trying to tantalize him with visions of his beautiful daughters dancing seductively in front of him, and that didn't work. And so then he pulled out his demon hordes, and they were hurling boiling mud and spears and lances at the Buddha. This is, of course, representative of the nature of pain that we can experience as we've been sitting for a while. And that doesn't work either. The Buddha still kept going deeper, still got more and more focused. And so finally, Mara said, "Ah, you don't have what it takes. Quit it now. Don't suffer like this. Go home to your wealthy home and your wife and your kid." But the Buddha to be was so deeply needing to know why people suffer. Why is it that we get old, we get sick, and we die? Why is it that people experience traumatic things even before that? Isn't there some way out? And he kept on going. And the next thing that happened to him was he started recognizing, remembering really, his past lives. And he saw how hard he had worked, and he was motivated to keep on. And then eventually he got to a point, mind state, where he forgot himself completely. And on the eighth morning, he raised his glance, caught the sight of the morning star, and that was enough to trigger a profound and final awakening experience. This after lifetimes of working at it. And the rest is history, because he had that profound, deep, freeing experience and taught for the next 40 years. And people he taught were able as well to reach that deep, profound, freeing experience and teach the next generations and so on down the line. And this is why it is so important, quite aside from becoming free, that we work toward that same experience of true liberation so that we too can pass it along to future generations, so that they too can be free of suffering, no matter what awful circumstances they're in. We're in a very challenging time of history right now. There are accusations of abuse in the government, of attempts to shut down the media so that news can be hidden. There are fights over what gets passed in Congress. There's secrecy around it. There are all kinds of other challenges. And then outside of America, there's also a tremendous amount of pain and suffering, bloodshed, hundreds of millions of people being displaced. There was recently a headline saying that nobody had any idea how many people would be injured in the Middle East. And it was just beyond people to be able to cope with it. There's a tremendous amount of suffering in the world right now. We are amazingly fortunate to be living where we are, even though we have our own aches and pains and concerns. We're not being bombed. We're not imprisoned. We're able mostly to eat. We're able mostly to live a relatively full life, a relatively happy life. We are deeply privileged. In some ways, perhaps, if we were less privileged, we'd be more deeply motivated to practice. But as we get older, sometimes that's enough motivation. Dogen Keegan, Ehe Dogen Keegan, lived only to 53, and then he died. How long will we live? And what will we see before we die? And how will we die? What will be our mind state? A verse to one of the koans in the Mamong Khan says, how will it be when the light of your eyes is failing? Will you be like the crab with its seven arms and eight legs struggling to get out of the boiling water? I leave that thought with you, and I pray that you will be deeply motivated to carry this practice to profound levels, to free yourself intimately, and then to work for the benefit of all beings. I thank you for listening. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.